Aloha, and welcome to the Hawaii Business Podcast, presented by Servco Pacific. In each episode, we talk with some of Hawaii's most influential business, nonprofit, and cultural leaders, and ask them about the important issues facing Hawaii and its people. We'll also learn a bit about each fascinating guest and have some fun along the way. Now, the host of the Hawaii Business Podcast, Anyang Nakata.
Humble and committed, Cobra Matsumoto exemplifies the ideals of local style leadership, service, and innovation with aloha. Today's episode is presented by Lexus Hawaii. The benefit of owning a Lexus goes beyond the joy of driving a luxury vehicle. Experience amazing with Lexus Perks. Enjoy unparalleled experiences and special offers at perks.servcolexus.com. Welcome everybody to the Hawaii Business Podcast. I have someone absolutely fascinating with me today, Colbert Matsumoto, Chairman of Island Holdings. Welcome, Colbert.
Good morning.
Hi, nice aloha shirt.
Oh, thank you.
That kind of a black, steel, blue, gray, I like it.
It's a Sig Zane, so.
Oh, gotta be. Okay, so most of our listeners will know that we tend to start at the beginning. I love to uncover where people come from, and you come from Lanai, which is fascinating. But there's something even more fascinating than that, that I'd like to start with, which is after law school, you spent about 6 months in a Zen monastery. So tell us why, how, and what was that like? Because I cannot even do the corpse pose in yoga. So I think someone that can enter into a Zen monastery and into that kind of rigor is very mentally and emotionally strong.
Well, you know, the origin of that actually stems from, you know, when I was a young boy, I was very interested in Japanese martial arts. And so, you know, I trained in Aikido for probably about 12 years before I actually entered the monastery.
Really? But then
my training in Aikido gave me a lot of interest in what the philosophical underpinnings were of Japanese martial arts. And so I had learned that Zen was an important influence. And so I wanted to learn more about what Zen was all about. And so I found out that there was a Zen temple up in Kalihi Valley. And, you know, my Aikido teacher had was friends with the Zen master at that temple. And so he arranged for me to be introduced there and have the opportunity to go there and meet him and then actually train there. So the teacher there invited me to actually live in after I finished my law education. So I took the bar exam, and after I took the bar exam, I went up to the temple, and then they shaved my head, and then I started to live in there. And so I stayed there for a period of 6 months.
What are some of the memories that you carry with you from that time?
Well, it was very difficult. It was one of the toughest experiences I've had in my life because the training was very intense, and it was a combination of both physical training as well as, I mean, just challenging mentally. The mental and emotional challenge of going through that rigor was probably even more difficult than the physical aspect of it, but it was a combination. I mean, while I trained there, I mean, I lost, you know, a lot of weight. I probably was in the best physical shape I had ever been after, you know, the 6 months. But more importantly, you know, it set me on a really different path than what I think I might ordinarily have gone down had I not actually lived there and gone through the training.
Mm. You know, after law school, after passing the bar, my best friend's an attorney, and I remember when she was going through that time and how hectic it was for her. And then for you to spend 6 months, it was almost like a reset, refocus, and a guiding light, and like your lighthouse, you know, kind of puts you on a very hyper-focused path of civic service and inner strength.
Well, you know, the path that I had been on before I went there to train was a very traditional path, right? I mean, I studied hard in high school. I, you know, got into college. I did well in college, and I got into a law school. And so, I mean, completed my law studies and took the bar. And so the next thing I was supposed to do was go work for a law firm. Well, this really caused me to divert in terms of that traditional path. And so as a result of my training at the temple, I actually, at the suggestion of the Zen teacher there, didn't go to work for a law firm, but instead actually opened up my own law practice. And so I hung my shingle up and I basically tried to figure out how to practice law on my own, which was not something that most people graduating from law school do, because certainly you haven't learned all the things that you need to know to be a good lawyer. And so it was a struggle for me. And on top of that, I was from Lanai. I didn't come from Honolulu, so I didn't know a lot of people in Honolulu. So I had to figure out how I was going to get clients. And so that was also a struggle. But I did that for 2 years before I finally decided that, okay, I need to go work for a law firm and actually have somebody that, you know, shows me the ropes, right? But during the course of those 2 years, I think that I learned a lot about myself. I learned about what it takes to start a business. And, you know, it was challenging, but it actually all came to benefit me years later, both in my law practice and after I left the practice of law.
Yeah, I can imagine. I can imagine. Okay, so now let's go back to the beginning, because now our listeners know that you're from Lanai, which I think is so interesting. Your parents were second generation Japanese Americans, and I believe that you grew up during what some would call a golden period of plantations in Hawaii. Mm. Your father was a 442nd veteran, correct?
That's right.
If I'm recalling this correctly, your mom was equally formidable. She was a Luna on the plantation, correct?
Yeah, she became a Luna on the plantation, but this was in the 80s. So it was when the Equal Rights Amendment was being considered, you know, for women. The feminist movement was starting to, you know, emerge. And so the plantation realized that they needed to give women an opportunity to have other jobs. Because prior to that, women were only used as laborers for the most part on the plantation. Mm-hmm. So my mother picked pineapple out in the pineapple fields for, you know, a couple of decades before she actually got promoted to be a Luna. And then she got promoted beyond that to be a field superintendent, which was pretty big deal on the plantation.
Oh, wow. Yeah, so your parents instilled some great values in you and your brother, correct? Because your father was also greatly involved in the ILWU.
Right. So my father was an officer with the local unit of the ILWU. So he was very much a union guy. And so through him, I learned a lot about the union, about the leaders in the union. And, you know, I came to admire the labor movement and the leadership of the labor movement, because the labor movement in Hawaii was what probably was the most significant factor in transforming post-war Hawaii. Mm. After World War II, it was really the labor movement, and in particular the ILWU, that organized the plantation and got the plantation workers to basically support the Democratic Party and led to the Democratic Party revolution of 1954 that people talk about. But you know, it wasn't just my parents that were influential with me. I actually had the benefit of experiencing my grandparents, who were Issei. They were first-generation immigrants. And my grandmother actually spent a lot of time raising me when I was a child. And so she shared with me a lot of, you know, the traditional Japanese values that she grew up with. And so, you know, I was fortunate because I had that opportunity to both experience, you know, the Issei and Nisei generation, both which experienced different kinds of struggles and had to overcome different kinds of challenges. And so, you know, for me, you know, the lessons that I gained from them were very important in terms of, you know, shaping my value system and my personal philosophy of life.
You know, you've stayed very committed to Japanese-American relations throughout your entire career, and I can better understand where that was rooted from. I also love that you mentioned your grandparents. Dan and I have one child, and his parents have always been so involved, and there is so much great value in that intergenerational learning, right? Because it really does take a village, and those prior generation values, more rooted, I think, also in heritage, are so important to pass on.
No, I agree with that. And that's why, you know, I think that, you know, I'm fortunate because, you know, I had that connection to my ethnic heritage through my grandparents, as well as my parents to some degree.
So you're from Lanai, small population. Was college always in the plans?
Oh, yeah. You know, I think that...
No choice from the parents and grandparents.
Well, yeah, and especially my parents, because my parents did not have the opportunity to go to college. And I think for them, you know, college was like the holy grail. You know,
that
they wanted to make sure that their children, you know, had the opportunity to go to college. And so, so they sent both me and my brother to college. And when I was growing up, you know, if there was something that they asked of me, that was the only thing. And all they expected was that I go to a four-year college and that I graduate. They didn't care which college. They didn't care what I studied and got a degree in. They just wanted me to have a college degree because from their perspective, a college degree and an education at that level was, you know, like a golden ticket. And so
I was thinking golden ticket at the same time. Yeah. Or were you and you're the first in your family to go to college?
Yes.
I was too. And it gives me a lot of great pride to have achieved that just for my extended family. I feel a lot of pride.
Well, you know, one of the things about that whole experience too, though, that, you know, really imparted to me the meaning of the Japanese term kodomo no tame ni, which is for the sake of the children, was, you know, after I started to work. In fact, it was when I was a law clerk in my second year of law school, and I got my paycheck from the law firm that I was clerking at. And, you know, when I got it, I realized that I was making more money than my parents were. And what hit home for me at that time was what they had to sacrifice in order to send me and my brother to college. And so, you know, I think that, you know, children often underestimate the sacrifices their parents make for their benefit. And so certainly, you know, I came to appreciate that about my parents.
Yeah, that was a real tangible moment for you when you saw that those numbers on that paycheck.
Right, because, you know, as plantation employees, mm-hmm. I mean, they weren't making a lot of money. They were wage earners.
Mm-hmm,
yeah,
so. So you go to USF, which many people may not know in sociology.
Uh-huh.
And I think it was your first time out of the state.
Right.
Correct?
When I went to the University of San Francisco, I had never left Hawaii. And so when I landed in San Francisco, it was my first time on the mainland. And I had no clue what I was supposed to do once I got there. And so I actually had an uncle that accompanied me from, I flew to LA first, where I met my uncle. And then he accompanied me on a flight from LA to San Francisco. Took us on an airporter bus from the airport to downtown San Francisco, and then got a cab and dropped me off at the dormitory. And then he proceeded to go back to the airport.
He was like, see ya.
Yeah, right. So it was like the first day of kindergarten, you're right. He handed me off to the college, you know. And so, but otherwise I had no clue as to, you know, what I was supposed to do once I got to, you know, the big city.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I guess in terms of cities that you could have landed in, San Francisco was a good choice, right? There was some diversity at that time, even at that time.
Oh, yeah.
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 Yeah. So after USF, you become a brother bear. You go to UC Berkeley.
Right.
So was law school always the trajectory?
We went to college with the objective of becoming a high school social studies teacher.
Are you serious?
Yeah. So that's what I really wanted to do. Because I admired my teachers in high school. They were so influential for me. And I enjoyed social studies. I enjoyed government. I enjoyed, you know, history. And so I wanted to be a high school social studies teacher. But unfortunately, when I was in college was at a time when there was that demographic transition that was not yet ready to take place between the baby boomers and the greatest generation. So the greatest generation, my parents' generation, were still very active in the workforce. So DOE still had a lot of teachers that were not yet ready to retire. And so when I was a sophomore, I realized after coming home to Hawaii, I worked at a Sears warehouse on the night shift. And there were three other guys working with me who had already graduated from UH. Two had education degrees. One had a master's degree in education. And the three of them still didn't get jobs.
And they were with you on the night shift at the Sears warehouse.
Right, because they couldn't get jobs at the DOE because there were no openings.
Wow.
So then it made me rethink what I needed to do. So that's when I thought, well, what am I going to do with a sociology degree? So I figured, well, okay, I'll take the law school exam and maybe I'll go to law school and become a lawyer, right?
So why law though? Because it's like, oh, so maybe I'll take the LSAT and I'll go to law school. And, you know, some people, many people struggle with that trajectory. So why law?
Well, you know, I was very naive about that. I had never met a lawyer before that. And I had this television notion of, you know,
like
based
Perry
on
Mason?
Perry Mason, the defenders of, you know, what lawyers did. And so I just thought that, you know, lawyers sounds like a, you know, pretty good job. You know, they make a lot of money and then they don't have to work that hard, right? And so,
the lawyers listening right now are like, are you kidding me?
Yeah. Well, you know, of course, I learned that it was otherwise. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that it did take a lot of work. But I naively thought that that would be a good path. And, you know, I'm glad that I took that path. But it took me a while before I finally realized that it was a great profession to be in.
So after your Brother Bear time, you came home and you actually had the great fortune of learning under Wally Fujiyama.
Right.
Tell us about that time.
Yeah, so I worked for Wally for 14 years until he passed away. Mm. And, you know, he was one of a kind. You know, I think that, you know, some people at the time considered him, you know, Hawaii's greatest trial attorney. And he had a track record that, you know, really justified that. He actually had a national reputation in terms of, you know, his abilities as a trial attorney. And but he was a very difficult taskmaster. I think that, you know, when I first joined his firm, people told me, oh, you know, you're going to join the plantation. Because, you know, the firm had a reputation for the attorneys that worked there having to work very long hours, you know, and I found that to be true.
Did Mr. Fujiyama know that his firm was called The Plantation?
Oh, I'm sure he heard it from people too, and he probably took pride in it.
Yeah, I was just going to say that.
Because he was a hard worker himself, mm-hmm. And so none of us dared leave the office.
He didn't expect others to do anything he wasn't already have done or willing to do.
Exactly. Right. And so none of us dared leave the office before he left, yeah. So we learned a lot. So working with him was a, you know, great opportunity to get a great education, not just in law, but also in life, in leadership, in community service. Because I think one of the things that I learned the most from Wally was the importance of serving your community. So as a lawyer, he didn't just see his profession as being one of, you know, working with the clients and making money, but he actually saw it as having a skill set that put him in a position where he could influence things and make a difference. And so he served on, you know, the Board of Regents. He was very influential with a number of other civic related activities. And so, you know, He always had this philosophy that he tried to impart on us that that the local kids were as good as anybody else. And so he wanted us to, you know, have that confidence in our ability and that, you know, we would, and he wanted us to, you know, demonstrate that through our work and our, you know, our activities. And so,
you know, I'm listening to you talk about Mr. Fujiyama. And it's almost like you're talking about yourself. So you're carrying his torch.
Well, that's I consider that quite a compliment if you think that's the case. Yeah,
yes.
Because I admired him. I thought that, you know, he was you know, an outstanding community leader, and you know, I mean, to the extent that I can emulate the, you know, the kinds of things that he was able to accomplish, you know, that would make me feel much more fulfilled, yeah, about, you know, my life.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, you know, starting with your family, your grandparents, your parents, your education, your Zen monastery time, Mr. Fujiyama, and everything in between, there has been a steadfast stream of expectations and love and information coming at you about a sense of responsibility, of giving back. You know, you don't just excel in your professional life, but what do you do with that? How do you leverage your influence? There's a very strong through line in your life.
Yeah, that stems from really all of my mentors and teachers, people that I admired. You know, I've been fortunate to have been exposed to so many people that felt that so connected to the communities that they were a part of. And so that recognition of, you know, the connectedness that we all have to the people around us, not just our families and neighbors, but to the community at large. And the fact that, you know, our lives, we all are the beneficiaries of that connectedness and the interrelationships that we have, instilled in me the sense that, okay, you know, you got to make a contribution to that. And you know, my teachers, my mentors, they all demonstrated that. And so for me, you know, I learned a lot from by their example. My parents were both very community-minded, and they volunteered with, you know, various organizations. And so, so you know, I had good role models.
Yeah. You know, your list of civic service is too long to itemize, but notably the Japanese Cultural Center, Central Pacific Bank, Hawaiian Host, it goes on and on. But last year, you were conferred the Order of the Rising Sun, Gold Rays with Rosette, by the government of Japan in a ceremony at the Japanese consulate. Share with us why it's been second nature to you to be one of the shepherds of this Japanese-American relations. And as an example of not just Japanese-American, but how the role that Hawaii can play in Korean-American, Chinese-American, Hong Kong-American. Basically, I truly believe that Hawaii has many, many strengths. And one of them is to be this, I know this sounds cheesy, but this aloha bridge, connecting people. We don't have as much conflict and visceral strife here. I believe that we can be the connectors of conversation and solutions. So tell us why it's been so important to you to be one of the shepherds for Japanese-American relations.
I would say that it stems from my growing up on the plantation. Because when I grew up on the plantation, you know, the plantation was basically made up of Asian laborers who came from the China, Japan, the Korea, the Philippines, Puerto Rico, to work on the plantation. And so growing up, I grew up with, you know, friends and other families from these different ethnic backgrounds. And so I saw how people interacted and worked with each other, but I also saw how they lived their lives and how there were shared values among those different cultures. And so to me, that cultural heritage from the plantation was, I think, what defined what we call local style. And so So I see the Japanese cultural connection as being an important part of perpetuating local style. That's why I think the Japanese tourists enjoy coming to Hawaii, because they feel very comfortable coming to Hawaii, because when they interact with people in the tourism industry that, you know, service them, I think that they feel very comfortable because they feel that there's this connectedness that and this sense of understanding between
and
them.
And sincerity.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so to me, you know, again, you know, that in part is derived from the influence of the Japanese immigrants that came to the plantations and how they shared their cultural heritage and their values with, you know, other people. And so that's why, to me, maintaining those kinds of cultural connections with the Asian countries is very important, because I think that they really help define the character and the culture of Hawaii.
Let's take a short break and hear a message from our presenting sponsor, Surfco Pacific. Today's episode is presented by Lexus Hawaii. Owning a Lexus goes beyond the joy of driving a luxury vehicle. It's a lifestyle. Experience amazing as a Lexus owner. Starting with the Lexus Takumi Master Craftsman, each specializes on a particular element of the production of your very own vehicle and has at least a quarter century of experience in their field. The Takumi's meticulous attention to detail, belief in excellence, and superior quality are unmatched. Lexus Hawaii owners are also invited to join Lexus Perks by Servco and enjoy unparalleled experiences at exclusive events, receive special offers and more just for being a Lexus owner. To learn more and experience amazing, visit LexusHawaii.com. Welcome back, everybody, to the Hawaii Business Podcast. Today, we're talking story with Colbert Matsumoto, chairman of Island Holdings. All right, Colbert. So after about 20 years in the legal profession, 2 years on your own, many years with Mr. Wally Fujiyama, you were asked to join the leadership team at Island. And it was founded in 1939 by Mr. Masayuki Tokioka, which I found out your middle name is Masayuki.
That's correct.
I think it's fate. But Mr. Frank Tokioka asked you to join the company and assume the leadership. So share with us a little bit about that time and why you said yes. It's quite a change, right? From being a practicing attorney to going into becoming an executive.
Well, I had already worked as an attorney for Island Insurance, outside attorney, for about 18 years before I was approached.
So they knew you well. They knew what you were made of.
Yeah. So Frank, and I had spent a lot of time with Frank outside of legal issues, getting to know him and him getting to know me. And we would talk about various topics. And so... But back when he approached me about joining the company, which was in 1998, the company was going through a very difficult time because the then CEO of the company was about to retire, but they had not planned for his succession. Mm. And the company was also struggling because it had been very traditional in terms of its approach to doing its business and had not kept up with a lot of the technological changes as well as the industry changes that were occurring in the insurance industry. So as a result, it had lost a substantial amount of its premium volume in the recent years. And so the path forward for the company was really uncertain. So Frank Tokioka was very troubled about it and wasn't sure, what to do. And so as we talked about it and, he shared, some of the challenges that he was facing, I sensed that he might be interested in me joining the company to help. And so I asked him if that's what he wanted. And so he told me, well, would you be willing to? And so I said, well, I'll think about it. And
you said, I'll think about it.
Well, I said, I'll think about it because it's a big decision, right? And so I got back to him shortly after that and told him that, yeah, I would be willing to do it. I was willing to do it because I really got to know the company and its corporate philosophy and its history. And I also knew that the local business community was changing. And I thought that if this company was no longer around, either because it got sold or it just, shut down, it would be a loss. And so I didn't want to see that happen because I wanted to see this company continue to be a player in our local business community and kind of contribute to local style of doing business. And so... the opportunity to actually join the company in a leadership role would give me that opportunity to try to make that difference. And so I thought that, that would be a great challenge for me to take up at the time. I was 46 years old at the time. And so I think that I had practiced law for 20 years. And so I was ready for a change. So, that's why I did it.
I'm listening to you. And what's so interesting is, today, Island Holdings has Island Insurance, Atlas Insurance, Tradewind Capital, Paxa, Pyramid Insurance, Islander Group, and Aloha Freight. And about 800 employees are all, within Hawaii, give or take a few. The Tradewind Capital, I was listening to you and in a nutshell, that's essentially what Tradewind does. Island Insurance is the only local insurance company, correct?
Right.
And then the Tradewind Capital portion of Island Holdings is also focused on, I believe, strengthening investing local companies or companies that have a strong local presence. But it's really about what you said about how is this going to affect the local workforce? How is this going to affect the local economy and the local community? That has stayed really true with you for over 20-something years.
Oh, yeah. No, I think that aligns with our corporate values, yeah, and what we're really trying to accomplish through our engagement in these different businesses that we're involved with. Because we think that local ownership makes a difference in terms of how a company operates and how a company interacts with its community. And so I think that by ensuring that there's this kind of local ownership, local management of these enterprises, I think that it's good for Hawaii and good for our community. Because we're isolated geographically and in a lot of other ways. And so when we have owners that are remote, it's not the same as when you have owners that are living in the community in which their companies are doing business.
I hear you. It's not right or wrong, but ownership by a private equity group or ownership by a global or national company is not quite the same as local ownership, where you might see them at Costco, you might see them at a baby luau, you're certainly going to see them at a fundraising dinner, but you're beholden to each other. Not like an IOU, but we have to lock arms and we're living in the community that we're affecting. I hear you on that.
Well, I think the Hawaiians have the term kuleana. Mm. And so, I think that it really represents that kuleana, that you have a sense of your responsibility to your community because you have a relationship with your community. When you don't live here, when, this is not, part of your everyday life, you don't feel the same way about, the relationship.
Mm-hmm. You don't feel the highs or the lows.
Right.
Right.
And you don't see the context in which your business is operating. Because, no business operates in isolation. Mm-hmm. Every business is influenced by, the environment in which it operates. And that environment includes the people in the community around it. And so, unless you have a feel for what the conditions are that are affecting, then you don't really even understand, what is influencing your employees and mm-hmm. what the concerns and challenges that your employees are facing.
You reminded me of something. Several years ago, there was a panel, Mr. Barry Taniguchi, Dwayne Carusu, and Alan Ikawa. It was a, what's in the water and Hilo kind of talk, uh-huh. right? Hilo entrepreneurs.
Right.
And there was something that, they said many sage things, but there was something that stuck with me, which is when we do business deals with each other or with you, people in the audience, it's not short term. It's not win-lose. It's win-win. And if I have to give up something for you to win, then that's what I'm going to do because it's a long game. Right? It's not the bottom line. It's not the short term. It's the long game because we got to live with each other.
Right. No, I think that, that approach to doing business is where you understand that, it's not just transactional. It's not just about making the deal. Yeah. It's about, entering into a relationship. And when you do that, business is so much more enjoyable. Because it's not just about the numbers. It's not just about, the material exchange. There's an emotional aspect to it that makes it so much more satisfying. Yeah, you may not make the best margin or the biggest profit from it, but there are a lot of other intangible, values that you get out of it that are important.
Mm-hmm. You and I have talked about this before, but we both truly believe that this concept of purpose and concept of profit, they should play in the same sandbox. It is not, either or.
Right. And I think that, a lot of businesses and a lot of people who are in business have lost sight of that. Mm. And, concerns me that, I think a lot of young people go to school today and, they approach business from a very much a quantitative perspective as opposed to, appreciating the qualitative aspect of the nature of business.
Mm-hmm. We talk about these soft skills, right? I hate that term, soft skills. Uh-huh. But I firmly believe it's these quote-unquote soft skills are, now we're more accepting, those are the skills necessary, absolutely, to be successful in life, not just business, but in life or whatever profession that you go into.
Right. And that's something that, you know, I learned through my Zen training, is that, you know, there are certain fundamental principles that underlie all human activity. And when you can understand what those principles are, you can apply them in different contexts. And so, you know, when you see that, yeah, then you start to realize that, yeah, there should be no separation, mm-hmm, between the various aspects of your life. And when you can actually understand that and start to incorporate that in how you live and, mm-hmm, how you conduct your life, yeah, then your life becomes whole and much more harmonious.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's why they say money doesn't bring you happiness.
Yeah.
I mean, I got to tell you, there's something that you just said I'm so jealous of. I so wish I could say, well, according to my Zen training, you can say that like legit. I'm so jealous. Okay.
Well, it's not too late to learn.
Let me master corpse pose in yoga first. So Island Holdings, share with me and the listeners what's in store. What are the priorities now and going forward? You know, you have strengthened the group from the inside out. You are investing. You are expanding. You are making real impact in the local workforce development. So what are the priorities going forward?
One of our goals is to empower local talent. So, you know, we want to work with local talent and hopefully, you know, find opportunities for them to prosper, not just within our company, but also within some of the businesses that we invest in. And so, you know, we hope that we can, you know, place young talent that work with us in organizations so they have the opportunity to show their ability and to help basically enhance not just the businesses that they're associated with, but also contribute to the community too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. There was something you said earlier in the talk story, and I've heard many folks like Susan Yamada and others talk about this as well. For example, when she was in Silicon Valley working, and, mm-hmm, she was a San Jose State graduate, and she was elbow to elbow with Stanford graduates, and she realized, they're no smarter than me. And in many ways, I can be better. And so many local youth are just as bright, just as capable, just as strong, just as resilient, but they lack the confidence. And so when I'm listening to you, what I'm hearing is that some of the work that Island Holdings is doing is investing in companies and investing in local talent to really shine a light and open their eyes to their own talent, to their own confidence that yes, you can. And until you believe you can, I'm gonna believe in you.
Right. You know, I think that for me, you know, one of the things that was imparted to me very strongly was when I worked with Wally Fujiyama. Because Wally wanted us to, the lawyers that worked for him, to feel that they were as good as anybody else, as any other lawyers that would come to Hawaii from the mainland, that came from big firms. You know, he demonstrated that to us, not just by his ability, but also by giving us the opportunity to prove it ourselves. And so when you actually start to do that, you start to gain confidence in your own ability. And I remember when I went to college at the USF, I didn't know how to speak anything other than pidgin English. And so my friends that I made in school used to laugh at me because they couldn't understand what I was saying. And I had to learn how to speak proper English. And so when I went to class, I was always reluctant to speak up because I thought that I would look foolish if I spoke in pidgin. But one of the things that I came to realize was that, you know, even though I spoke with an accent or in pidgin English, you know, I wrote very well. I did very well in my classes. And I came to realize that some of the kids that seemed like they were very articulate and spoke a lot didn't necessarily do it quite as well. And so I started to gain more confidence in myself and my, you know, ability and my intelligence, because, you know, just because you speak pidgin didn't mean that you weren't as smart as somebody else who didn't. Yeah.
Does that pidgin still count?
Can I talk pidgin?
Yeah.
You think somebody from Lanai will forget how to talk like that?
Your feet touch down on Lanai and it just comes out?
My kids, you know, laugh whenever I encounter somebody who's, you know, talking in pidgin, because I start to respond like that too.
And then when the conversation ends, they're like, wow, Dad, okay, that was interesting.
They just laugh about it.
Okay, there was one thing that I did want to ask you for your thoughts and your status update on. A few years ago, you were a major contributing force in a report that came out from the Hawaii Executive Conference. Tradewind Capital was part of it, Sterling Higa was part of it, the Hawaii Tax Foundation was part of it, and you were part of it. Although, you know, you weren't listed by name in the article, I know for a fact that you were part of the impetus behind it. And it noted that there was about $88 billion in estimated liabilities for state and local governments over the next 30 years, primarily in infrastructure, pensions, and climate change, and then majority within infrastructure in transportation and public education commitments. Can you talk story with us about your role with that, but more importantly, what progress, if any, has been made in the past couple of years?
Yeah, so that was a report that was titled Troubled Waters that I worked on with an intern who was working with me at the time named Jeff Laupola, who just recently got his MBA from Columbia University, and Sterling Higa, who is now the head of the Housing Hawaii's Future, mm-hmm. a nonprofit advocating for, you know, housing for Hawaii's young people. But at the time, I had enlisted them in working with me as well as a group of others in researching the challenges, fiscal challenges that Hawaii's governments were facing, both at the state and local level. Because I used to serve as a trustee of the state retirement system. And while I served as a trustee, I came to understand how short the system was in terms of its funding adequacy. At the time, the funded ratio for the public employee pension had fallen to about 58%. And so what that meant is that, you know, it didn't have enough assets to meet all of its liabilities and had to kind of build it up. So that was a potential burden on the public employers to basically contribute to that. And so that liability, both for the pension as well as for the health fund, was almost $28 billion in total.
Jeez.
And in addition to that, there were these reports that were coming out about how there was all this billions of dollars in deferred maintenance for public schools, billions of dollars in deferred maintenance for our transportation systems and other infrastructure. And then there was the specter of climate change and sea level rise that was on the horizon. And nothing had been done to really analyze what needed to be done to address climate change and the adaptation to sea level rise that Hawaii was going to have to invest in. And so we thought that it was important to compile a report that attempted to summarize what these liabilities were so that people would be aware of this and understand that to act responsibly means that we have to take stock of what these liabilities are and start to be more measured about how we expend our resources. Mm-hmm. And so that was the intent behind the report. And so at the time, you know, I mean, like any report like that, you know, it gained a certain level of notoriety. But then it often gets forgotten and then gets lost in the mix. Yeah. And so I hope that there's still some level of a legacy connected with it and awareness on the part of public officials as to the kind of priorities that they need to maintain. But, you know, one example, for example, I'll mention is that there's a recent story about how the Hawaii Honolulu Police Department has all this overtime. And it would appear that there's a certain level of overtime abuse or lack of proper management of overtime by the police department. Well, that overtime is contributing to that unfunded liability for the public pensions, mm-hmm. because public safety comprises a huge part of the unfunded liability for the public pensions. And so as that overtime continues to increase, the liability for retired police officers increases exponentially.
So when I was reading some materials on the report, they share there's three possible ways to combat it at the same time. Well, first and foremost is it's a macro approach, and that public and private partnerships really just have to talk together. And the government as a whole has to be a little bit more measured in reducing their expenses, start saying no to certain things, right? And that's easier said than done. But one of the ways that the article talked about was to grow the economy. And we all know, we hear news weekly, you know, monthly, regularly, of the difficulty that businesses of all sizes face in to be successful in Hawaii. I'll give you one example, permitting. Right. So has there been, where do you see that portion of the solutions? Have we made any progress in the past couple of years, or has it gotten worse?
Just anecdotally, on the permitting side of it, I mean, it doesn't seem like there's progress been because I keep hearing that people are still waiting extended periods of time to get their permits through. But by the same token, you know, I have had the opportunity to talk to some public officials about the challenges that they're facing in addressing that problem, because their workforce challenges, they're having difficulty hiring employees. So staffing is a big part of it. But they're also hamstrung in terms of what they can do with the staff that they have, because we have, I think, civil service laws and collective bargaining contracts that tie their hands and tie the hands of the managers in terms of what they're able to do. So you know, there's a lot of things that need to be done from a management standpoint to reassess, you know, what kind of tools are we going to give the managers to be able to properly deal with these kinds of problems that challenges that government is facing.
You know, what I'm hearing from you is to lay people, I think when we see, when we hear this, when we hear about the permitting issue, it's easy to think, oh, well, they don't care, or they don't see it, or they're not fixing it. But what I'm hearing from you is they do care, they do see it, they do want to fix it, but they're also dealing with some of the challenges that the for-profit side is dealing with, right? Workforce development. But on top of that, union complexities and other public complexities, and it's very complex.
Right, it is, and you know, and so there's structural impediments that you know, I think basically create obstacles for that kind of change. So with government, I think what you know has to happen is that, you know, I mean, people tend to think that, oh, you know, I mean, we'll just appropriate, like, you know, millions of dollars for this, and you think that somehow fixes it. Well, without looking at structural change, you're not going to fix it. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, that's one of the fundamental things that, you know, the politicians are going to have to wrestle with and figure out, because clearly it's going to get some special interest groups upset and concerned. And there's going to be resistance to it. And so to bring about change, you have to have leaders that have the political will and courage to advocate for those kinds of change and to adopt those kinds of changes. I mean, in the private sector, you know, organizations are challenged all the time with, you know, changing competitive environment and circumstances. And so to overcome that, to succeed, private entities are constantly challenged with embracing change. Mm-hmm. But for organizations to change, you need change agents, mm-hmm. that have the will and the tenacity to bring about the changes that are necessary.
And courage.
Right.
Right, because it's not easy, and sometimes you stand alone.
Right. Yeah, and so, you know, I think that's you know, a key part of leadership. I mean, you know, no leader can, you know, be successful if, and I'll share a quote that Wally Fujiyama used to
say.
Okay. Wally used to say, show me a leader that has no enemies, and I'll show you somebody who hasn't accomplished much. And so, you
know, I've heard that before.
Oh, yeah.
I've heard it before. Winston Churchill?
Okay. Could be.
Okay.
But you know, I think that that's very true. Mm-hmm. You know, if you want to bring about change, you're going to get some people upset. And, you know, it's unfortunate, but that's just the reality of life. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think that it takes a lot of courage for people to accept that and to promote change in spite of the fact that people are going to talk stink about you and people are going to criticize you and kind of trash you at times, right? And so you got to be willing to deal with that.
Right.
Yeah, and that's why, you know, I think that, you know, it's important to really think deeply about, you know, what is really important in terms of what will make you feel not just happy, but what will make you feel fulfilled about your life and what you did with your life.
I love that you said that. So I have, this sounds really strange, but I think happy is a farce. When we talk about be happy, but it's really about being appropriately challenged, fulfilled, rewarded, content. You feel good quietly behind the scenes. You don't need to boast about everything that you're doing. So I'm anti-happy. I'm pro-fulfilled. I love that you said that. Okay, Colbert, before we say goodbye to our listeners, tell me, if you could have any superpower, what would it be and why?
I guess if I would say that I would like to have the ability to time travel. Because, you know, if I had insights into both the future as well as the past, because, and I say the past because oftentimes we don't really learn about history properly and we don't really fully benefit from the experiences that have already preceded us. Yeah. And so I'd like to have a better sense as to, okay, what really happened in the past and will it be helpful to me today? Likewise, if I could see into the future, then I can anticipate what I need to do today. Yeah, but
you still love social studies, don't you?
Oh, yeah.
Well, thank you, Colbert. We could talk forever, but I so enjoyed Talking Star with you today. Thank you for being so open. Thank you for talking pigeon for me, and have a wonderful day.
Yeah, thank you very much. Enjoyed it.
You've been listening to the Hawaii Business Podcast, presented by Surfco Pacific. All episodes are available on Spotify, Apple Podcast, Google Podcast, Stitcher, and of course at hawaiibusiness.com. If you enjoyed today's interview, go to your podcast platform of choice and hit the subscribe button. And also, leave us a review. Positive reviews encourage others to tune in as well, and that raises the tide of meaningful conversation towards solutions in Hawaii. I'm your host, Anyang Nakata. Thank you for joining us today. Be safe, be well, and see you next time.